Hi, everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual and our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is Paula R. She spoke a few years ago, and it was one of the good ones. I mean, it was a profound, there was a lot of help there. She sponsors a lot of women, and a lot of her sponsees have come to tell their stories here, and other people that she works with. This network just keeps tangling itself up, untangling itself up. I'm just so glad to be able to introduce her one more time. Paula R.
Everybody, family, I'm Paula. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a very scared alcoholic right now. One of my big fears is public speaking. I'm very, very comfortable one-on-one. I am terrified up in front of a bunch of people. But one of the tools that I've learned is when you talk about what you fear, it gets smaller. So I'm talking about it. thank you for inviting me to speak. It's always an honor. I always learn something every time I tell my story, and it's been a while, so I'm due. And I'm sure I'll come away with some new realizations tonight. It's funny, when you look back, that sounds crazy to say, but even though it's my story, I see different things. I see connections I didn't see before. I just see stuff, and hopefully something will be useful to someone in here tonight. My sobriety date is April 12, 1995. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I am a sponsor today. I sponsor a number of women, some of whom are in this room. I have some grand sponsees in this room. This is one of the great, great pleasures of my recovery to have women that I work with. It's an honor to go through this process with them. I came by my seat honestly. Take your way back. I was born in Germany. I was brought over to the United States at 2 weeks old because I was adopted. I was born to an American mother and an American father in the military, but they were not married, and it was a private adoption arranged through a priest, and my father was in the military, and they went to Germany and got me and brought me back, and I mention that just because I always grew up knowing I was adopted, and I always thought that that was probably, that had to be why I never felt like everybody else, like I fit in. I always felt uncomfortable in my own skin. I always felt like I was defective. In fact, I felt like Dumbo in that movie. You know, I had been delivered by a stork to, you know, parents awaiting me, and then when I was unwrapped, I was a little different. You know, I was a little odd. And I just felt like an alien. When I was, my mother had been told she couldn't have kids, so she had adopted my older sister and then myself, and then surprise, she had had my little brother. And for a long time, it was just the five of us, and we were a pretty happy family. And then she was a good Catholic woman and decided she wanted to continue to expand the family, and she adopted again, and she adopted my brother, Scott, who was 8 years old and who had been in a couple of foster homes. And he came with some emotional baggage. And then 2 years later, she adopted my little sister, Danielle, at age 3, and she had cerebral palsy. And suddenly, I think my mother found herself very busy with kids with special needs. And she relied on the older kids in the family, which was my older sister and myself. So my job became to just, you know, be her right arm. And we lived in a middle-class South Jersey neighborhood, had a five-bedroom home. And it was my job to set the table, clear the table, make the salad, do the laundry for seven people every week, clean the house, five-bedroom house every week, and mow the lawn, watch my little sister whenever necessary. And my high school experience was just that. That's what I did. I cleaned the house, I set the table, I did the dishes. And eventually that morphed into making dinner and cleaning it up. And I grew up feeling very much like an indentured servant. Like, what was important about me was that I performed. Just shut up and perform, Paula, because I got two other kids over here that need all my time and all of my energy, and I can't handle anything from anybody else. So what do you mean that dish isn't clean? What do you mean you don't have time? What do you mean that laundry isn't folded? You know, shut up and just do the list. And so the message I got real early on was that it was performance that mattered. It was not my feelings and my needs. My needs were not important. Everybody else's were important. And that I was just to shut up and show up. And so early on, what I did with that was decided that, instead of deciding that I could be a useful, helpful part of a family system that needed some help, I took that as there must be something wrong with me. It's part of that defect I've always felt. I'm not worthy. I'm not good enough. No matter how hard I try, it's never enough. And I never will be enough. And by God, nobody's going to take care of me, so I'll just take care of me. So I turned that into, one of my early tools for survival, which was self-reliance. My first beer was at home. My dad was a good Air Force guy, so there was lots of parties, lots of military parties. He drank away from home, and they also entertained a lot at home. And so sometime in junior high school, I had my first drink at home. I don't remember it exactly. I don't remember exactly how old I was. I remember the circumstance, though. It was a beer that was on the dining room table in our dining room, and it was somebody else's beer. And I sneaked a drink, and I just remember immediately that there was a peace, there was a calm, there was a relaxation that came over me. Suddenly the anxiety that I always lived with seemed to disappear. The fear that I had, I felt like there wasn't anything I couldn't do. There wasn't anything. I could say things, people would laugh. I was funny. I was happy. I became a real person instead of this shell that performed. I became a person with feelings and a validity and joy. And I couldn't get enough of that. I started sneaking drinks. Now, this is junior high school. There wasn't a whole lot of opportunity, but had more opportunity in high school. French food day, I made rum cakes so I could bring a whole bunch of extra rum to school. Got good and drunk that day in school. Joined the drama club because I heard they had great cast parties, and they did. And there were lots of after rehearsal parties. I remember getting really drunk one time at the school after school, after a rehearsal, and somebody had to drive me home. I became bulimic in high school. One of my other early tools for survival was control, since I felt so out of control in my family. So I would eat in an out of control way and then stick my finger down my throat. and get rid of it. My parents suspected that for a long time, but never said anything. And I only mention that. I know that's an outside issue, but that is something that I was able to get great help for right here, surprisingly. But again, a tool for living of mine early on was control. I would try harder. I would do whatever it took to manage, you know, whatever I was trying to manage. And if I couldn't manage one behavior, I'd do another behavior to try and manage that behavior. Went away to college in Virginia to get away from home. Mom and I fought all the time. I hated her. I was convinced she hated me. When Mom and I fought, Dad and Mom fought. And so it was like I wasn't allowed to have a relationship with Dad because that made it difficult for me to have a relationship. It just screwed everything up. Then Mom and Dad had trouble, and then Mom and I had trouble. Mom and I were always having trouble. Real early on, I shut down. And going to college was getting away from home for me. And it was freedom. It was also my first geographic cure. I was able to drink like I really wanted to, finally. And in high school, it had been beer and maybe some wine, you know, whatever I could sneak. In college, it was red eyes. It was Schlitz. I could get a six-pack for $2.50 in 1981. It was Pabst Blue Ribbon. It was Boone's Farm. It was Mad Dog 2020. You know, and I had a cast iron stomach. I could mix it all. I didn't seem to get hangovers. I could drink shots of liquor, and then I could drink beer afterwards, and I just seemed to do just fine. Learned that if I took some Black Beauties, I could drink even more. Learned that if I ate a high-protein meal like tuna right before Friday night drinking began, I could drink even more. So, you know, early on I was finding ways to manipulate things so that I could drink even more. And there were plenty of times where I put my finger down my throat and threw up whatever I needed to throw up so I could continue to drink. That was just how I liked to drink. Did discover cocaine in college as well, which also let me drink even more. And I just mentioned these other chemicals because they are part of my story. Alcohol is what got me here, but those were part of what allowed me to drink the way I really wanted to drink. Bad things started happening. I would wake up in places I didn't remember getting to. I would wake up with clothes missing, with people I didn't know. There were some early warning signs in college. One guy I drank with temporarily went blind from drinking. I haven't heard of that before or since, but that's how we drank. Another friend of ours, his name was Jeff. We had this May party at the end of my freshman year. I went to school my freshman year in Virginia State, and it was the western part of the state near the Shenandoah Valley, and there were beautiful Virginia mountains, and we'd party up in these mountains because there was no alcohol allowed on campus. And so we had about 18 kegs up there in this clearing on the top of this mountain called Flagpole, and this guy in our class named Jeff tried to drive down the mountain that night and didn't make it and was killed. And Jeff was the only child of older parents. And we all went to that funeral, and I will never forget how devastated they were. And that should have been a warning, but it was just one of those I could not heed. I just was not ready to relate those kind of problems to my drinking. I got in trouble in school. By the beginning of my sophomore year, I'd been written up at least 4 times for having either alcohol or men in our rooms, and we weren't supposed to have either, ever. you were allowed to be written up 3 times in 4 years. I was written up four times in a year and a quarter. So they called me aside one day and they said, you know, Paula, why don't you think you ought to take some time off? Why don't you take a quarter off? And I negotiated that they just not put that on my transcript and that I would transfer out of the school. And so they agreed to that, and I transferred back home to Rutgers, where I could go and I could pay for school. Mom had always had an issue paying for college. This way I got her off my back about that. It did mean I'd have to live at home to make it happen, but I was willing to do what it took to be able to stay in school because I saw school as my ticket out. I called my parents to let them know I needed them to come get me, and my dad got on the phone and said, you know, we're not coming. Find your own way home. And I was devastated. But I found my own way home. You know, I had already gotten the lesson that if I didn't take care of me, nobody else would. So it wasn't a big surprise. And I found my own way home. And for the next 3.5 years, my drinking kind of got squashed while I lived at home, went to school, and just kind of kept my head down. Dated a guy the last couple of years. I was at Rutgers that I'd known in high school. Married him as soon as I graduated. Graduation day, I walked that morning, and my parents went to another party at one of their friends' houses, and my boyfriend picked me up, and we spent the day together. And he asked me to marry him, and I couldn't think of a good reason not to. I had no reason not to be with somebody that seemed to express, you know, care and concern for me. And it solved a lot of problems for me. It got me out of a house I hated living in, got me away from a mother that was starting to talk about rent. It solved a lot of problems for me. So I got married. And about 6 months later, figured out that was probably not the best idea. And about 9 months later, finally told him about that and left. And that was another geographic cure. I was starting to have more geographic cures. I was having to run from one place to another. Escape was the tool for living that I was getting very, very familiar with. So I left him and moved across the, out of New Jersey, across the river to Philadelphia, and got a one-bedroom apartment, found out I could, on my meager salary, make ends meet. And but now I lived alone, and there was no reason, you know, there was nobody to tell me what I could or couldn't do. I drank almost every day. I had to be at work at 5 a.m. It was shift work. I worked at a plant called Mrs. Paul's Kitchens that made the fish sticks and fish fillets, and worked on first shift, 5 a.m. to 2, and I'd get home around 3:30, start drinking around 4 while I made dinner. I'd have that glass of wine, and that would turn into 2 and into a bottle and then often into 2 bottles. And it was usually midnight or 1 a.m. before I was finally getting to sleep, and I had to be back at work at 5 a.m. And I did that for about 3 years. I got promoted 3 times while I was there because I was a good worker, but I was late a lot and was starting to have some trouble just getting to work on time. Promptly fell in love with one of my supervisors, and he was married, unfortunately, but that didn't stop us. And so now I'm 22 years old. I'm divorced from someone I didn't want to marry. I'm in an affair with someone I can't marry. I'm estranged from family. I'm as alone as I can be. Work, which had been my only solace, was now problematic, and I needed another geographic cure. So I looked around and decided that I would change careers, and I would move to Atlanta and enroll in chiropractic school. So that's exactly what I did. In a way, it was a chance to kind of recreate the student life I felt like I had not enjoyed in my undergraduate school. I got to drink and be a student like I'd wanted to be. And there's lots of opportunities to drink when you're a student, you know, after every midterm, after every final, any social event. You know, I was the leader of the pack. The party was often at my house. And it could be around volleyball or swimming or, you know, just because we had a midterm that day. Graduated from chiropractic school in 1991, pregnant. And yet another standard had been broken. I was divorced, I'd had an affair, and now I sought some counsel from an instructor, and which was that the best thing for me to do was to terminate that pregnancy. So in my mind, that was the third big standard. One of those three things I told myself I would never do. I'd never get a divorce, I'd never have an affair, and I'd never, you know, have an abortion. And by, you know, 28, I'd done all three. And they say your bottom is when your behavior gets bad faster than you can lower your standards. And that's exactly what was happening to me. My standards, I was slowly breaking every one of them, and before I had actually decided to, it seemed. And but I still didn't see any of this as a result of the way I drank. I just drank like everybody else that I knew drank. You know, it was just what you did when you had time off. I remember having a conversation with someone who didn't drink once, and I remember thinking, well, what do you do? You know, if you don't drink on a Friday night, what do you do after work? I had no category for not drinking. Graduated from chiropractic school, worked as an associate chiropractor for a couple of years. And what that precipitated for me was a very conscious search for some kind of standard. I had to have some rationale, some standard by which to practice. Because there were judgment calls you can make in practice. You can tell people they need to come 50 times or, you know, 5 times. You know, there was judgment in that. And I knew people doing it both ways. And I needed to find some sort of reason to do what I thought was the right thing to do. And I was running out of reason. So it was a very conscious search, really, for God for me. I needed some standard higher than myself. Because obviously my own standards, I kept blowing right through. So I decided, I talked to a counselor back at chiropractic school, and he had recommended that I go to a Bible study. And so I went to a Bible study to try and find God, and found a God of my understanding in that Bible study. And it was a wonderful thing. But I drank for 2 more years. I fell in love with a God of my understanding, but I did not know how to stay stopped. I did not know how not to pick up the next drink. I would buy 2 bottles of wine on the way home from that Bible study, and just because I was going to have 1 glass while I made dinner that night. And without fail, every single time I drink all of both bottles. There was no way I could save alcohol in my kitchen. I worked for 2 years in that associateship, then went to work with another doctor. And one of his patients that I was taking care of came in and ended up taking me to my first AA meeting. And I remember sitting in the back thinking, I didn't know what to think at first, but what I thought was, this is really great for you guys. You know, this is really great. But this is not my problem. But several months later, I finally picked up my first white chip, and that was August 22nd, 1993. Life was kind of in a crisis. I had been asked to leave the second practice I was working with. So I was starting up my own practice out of a friend's basement, that friend in AA. And I picked up a white chip, and I was praying on my knees every day because I truly did not know what would happen. I was living hand to mouth. If I could not make this work, I was going to be on the street. Going home was not an option for me. So I'm hitting my knees every day, and I am so committed to AA just because I'm so scared. I was desperate. I had the gift of desperation. I've heard speakers describe it. And God showed up. While I spent about 3 weeks seeing my patients that I was able to take with me out of the basement of this friend's condo, and I was driving by this strip of road on Shanley Dunwoody Road, every time I drive by it, I'd look around and think, gosh, why is there, I'm drawn to this area. And one day I drove by and there was this little sign at the mailbox that said home/office for rent. So I pulled in real quick and wrote down the number and drove home and called and rented that office. And it ended up being a perfect location. Year and a half later, I bought that building and started my practice there. I started as soon as I moved in, a month later. And a year and a half later, I actually bought it. And God kept showing up. My practice kept growing. I was in an area that had meetings within 2 miles in any direction. So I went to a meeting Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. It was just awesome, and I didn't have to drive far at all. And that first year, I remember, you know, finishing my work day and thinking, why do I have to go to a freaking meeting? You know, why me? Why this? You know, and I'd gnash my teeth and I'd get in my car and I'd want to get out of my work clothes and I'd want to eat and just put my feet up and relax. And I'd drive 2 miles, you know, to the meeting down the road and just hating it, just feeling so resentful that I had to do this just to stay sober. You know, poor me. Why me? And every single time I would drive home and I would have this incredible relief. I would have this peace. I would feel so much better. And it would happen the next night, and it would happen the next night, and it would happen the next night, until one time, finally, I remember getting in my car, and it's starting to feel grumpy, and then I just remember thinking, Paula, just shut up. You know you're going to feel better in an hour. And the meetings, what I found was what the meetings did for me was the same thing that alcohol did for me. They gave me immediate relief. If I brought myself to a meeting, it had that effect on me. It changed me. I felt different. And so for the first year and 9 months, I came faithfully because I was too scared not to. I did my best to work the steps with my sponsor at that time. Sat down and told her things I never thought I'd share with another human being. Found out they weren't that big of a deal. She had stuff that was very similar. So suddenly, you know, we had stuff in common. But the entire time I secretly thought, you know, I haven't lived under a bridge. I haven't prostituted myself for alcohol. You know, I haven't had a really low bottom. Like a lot of the stories I'm hearing in here, I'm not really sure I've earned my seat, you know. And in April, a couple of things happened. I met my birth mom and her entire family. So I was like, you know, the mystery guest. Came out to her whole family. I bought the building I was in, which meant that I had to clean out my whole bank account and put that as a down payment on that building. And it also meant that I was now committed to that building, which I yet had never bought a property before, and that was a big deal for me. And I broke up with a guy I'd been dating, which, of course, you know, I waited until 11 months to do that. And I had gone to a lot of meetings. I had done... You know, I'd kind of worked the steps, but I had not really practiced the tools. I had not really applied this program. And when I was hit with the fear of meeting all these people that I was related to, that were family that I didn't know, and the feelings, the commitment of owning this building, the feelings of breaking up with somebody and, you know, being rejected now in sobriety. I just did not have the tools to deal with that. And I went home one night, and all I wanted was one drink, you know. So I bought myself a bottle of port wine and poured myself one drink and drank the whole thing. And saw, finally, in that action that everything the book had said, you know, that I had read was really true. That the minute I drank, it was all I wanted to do. It didn't matter that I'd spent 8 years going to school, 2 years in an associateship, you know, that I'd borrowed money from friends to start this practice up, and that, you know, Wednesday, tomorrow, the next day was my busiest day in practice. None of that mattered as soon as I had that first sip. All I wanted to do was more, was drink more. And you know, if I had been sober enough to drive, I'd have gone to the store and gotten another bottle and drank more. So the relapse was the best thing that ever happened to me. I woke up the next day, had the first and last hangover I've ever had. It was my busiest day of the week. I got through it, and I went and picked up a white chip that night. It was a Wednesday night. And finally conceded to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic. I don't have to have a low bottom to qualify. The diagnosis fits. And it was, you know, it was kind of the worst day and the best day all in the same day. It was the last thing I really wanted to accept. But at the same time, there was relief in the idea that I didn't have to. It wasn't that I was weak. It wasn't that I was stupid or that there was something I could be doing better to control it. There was sort of grief and relief in that step one all at the same time. The grief was, oh, shit, you know, this means I can't drink. You know, I have to give up my answer, which alcohol had been my answer. It was not my problem. It was never my problem. It was the one thing that made me feel alive and real and human to me. And now I had to give that up. I was not happy about that. But yet, I also knew that the struggle was over because I was starting to feel like I was going crazy. I couldn't understand why I could not pick it up. I seemed to be able to do whatever else I applied myself to. I had put myself through school. I had started a practice. I had, you know, found my birth mother. I had done all these things. You know, why could I just not drink one day at a time? I was beginning to think I was crazy. There really was something wrong with me. And so when I could finally concede to my innermost self that I could not drink successfully, that I was an alcoholic, that I had a physical allergy and a mental obsession, which I was later to understand was what that meant, it changed everything for me. 2 and 3 were not hard. I had already found a God of my understanding and did not have any trouble with that God. The problem was I didn't do a lot of turning over. I could believe that God could help me, but I had to learn how to use that. I had to learn how to surrender. And so I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps again. And I did a more honest 4th and 5th than I had the first time, and I revealed some more things. And again, I had the same experience. She shared with me things that I didn't think, you know, anybody else had hit some of the lows I'd hit, and she'd hit some lows that were just like mine. It was, I'll hurry up here. At 5 years sober, I was at this point where I was kind of bored in recovery. Life was better. Life was a lot more manageable. I was going to meetings 5 days a week. I was dating somebody in the program. All my friends were in the program. Everybody I hung out with was in the program. It was just always with program people. But it was kind of like, is that all there is? You know, you just go to meetings, you hang out with a lot of sober people, and you talk recovery. And so, and then a friend of mine who kept asking me to come to this one meeting over in Sandy Springs, kept asking me to come to this meeting, and so I finally went there, and it happened to be it was at Sandy Springs Christian Church, and I heard these street smart tattooed guys stand up in the meeting and say that the most important thing in their recovery today was their relationship with their higher power. And I had never heard that in the other meetings. They had probably been said, mind you. I just hadn't heard it in any of the other meetings I'd been to. And so I thought, well, this is new. You know, this guy's talking about God. And look at him. You know, who would have thought? I'm coming back. And so I did. I kept going back to that meeting. And that meeting was very strong, strongly advocated getting into a book study. So I thought, well, you know, I haven't done that. I'll do that. So I got involved in a book study, and the woman who led the book study, I asked to be my sponsor, because I was kind of between sponsors at the time. I had not sponsored anyone yet myself, and that book study totally transformed my understanding of recovery. When I got into the book, I learned some key things. I learned that there are three parts to this program: the problem, the solution, and the practical program of action. I learned that the problem, which is our disease, has two parts. It's the mental obsession and the physical allergy. And the book tells me very clearly the greater part of our disease is the mental obsession. And that is why we need the practical program of action, which leads us to the solution. So part two, second part of the program, is the solution, which is God. And part three is the practical program of action, which is the steps that you work to get that relationship with that God, that higher power, that God of your understanding, because that is what is between you and a drink when it's you and your head in that dark alley and you can't get somebody on the phone and you can't get somebody, you know, you can't, it's just you and your head. The spiritual program is the solution. I did not know that until I got into the book. I'd spent 5 years in this program and did not really understand my own disease and did not really understand the solution. So I started praying for sponsees. And one by one, God put some sponsees in my life. The first one was a woman named Jill. She came up to me after a meeting. She said, "Paul, I've heard you share. Would you please listen to my fifth step? My sponsor is really busy. I've had this fifth step done for like 2 months. I got to get it out of my system. Would you please listen to it?" I was like, "Well, sure. You know, okay, let's go." And so I had no experience sponsoring. I didn't know you're supposed to start with step one, but I thought, all right, you know, we got to get this fifth step off her chest. So we did, and you know, when you pray for, I've been praying for sponsees for about a year, but I just wasn't ready for them. When I was ready, they showed up. And I'm running out of time. It goes so fast. But, you know, my process of recovery has been a process of just surrendering to things I didn't understand necessarily. I did my amends without fully understanding how they were going to have anything to do with my not drinking. In fact, that was exactly my thought when I first got here, was I looked at those steps and I thought, those are great, but what does that have to do with not drinking? I did what I did because I was just too afraid not to. It was very clear to me I couldn't go back. I had no idea what I was jumping off into, but I just knew I couldn't go back. And it felt like I was stepping off a cliff blindfolded. What it turned out to be was the safest bet I've ever placed in my life. Getting into this program and getting a sponsor and working the steps means you have a guide, you have a manual that was written 70, 80 years ago, tried and true, tested and proven by tons of people all over the world. So I had a personal guide, I had a manual with clearly outlined steps, and I had a room full of people with plenty of experience to talk to, you know, and get counsel from when I needed it. There couldn't have been a safer bet for me to place, but it felt like the hugest risk I ever took. And it still felt that way as I went through some of these steps. I started to get a little bit of peace after my fifth step, did my sixth step, couldn't understand why six and seven weren't the same step until I got there, and then I had a lot of trouble with six. I felt I had deserved some of my resentment. You know, I had a right to be upset that I had not been treated the way I felt I should have been as a child. And when I finally went to make that amend to my mother, the best I could come up with for an amend was that I did not appreciate what she had done for me. That was the best I could come up with. And I knew I wanted to make the amend. I knew I needed to make the amend. I wanted to make it because I wanted to get to the other side of it. I wanted what you guys had. You guys sat in front of me and had a peace, and you were able to laugh at yourselves. You told stories worse than mine and weren't ashamed. You had successful lives. You had successful relationships. I so wanted that. And I went to make the amend to my mother, having no clue how it would go. And I took her out. She lived in New Jersey. I lived in Atlanta. I flew up there and asked if she could step out on the back porch. And I said, "Mom, you know, it's something I want to tell you. You know, I feel like I just really haven't appreciated, you know, all you've done." And that was about all I could get out, because that was about all I knew how to say. And she looked away and she sat down, and she said, she seemed to get it. And she said, "You know, we had some horrible years as a family. And I understood in that moment that the whole family system that I had been in, you know, my part in my resentment for her was I was only looking at what I didn't get. I was only looking at how all of that dysfunction, all of that insanity affected me. I was failing to see how everybody in my family was in pain and was struggling and was suffering. And my focus had only been on me. I finally saw, you know, my part in that amend. And if I had not willed myself to go through it, if I had not trusted you people and these steps and just done what you told me to do, I never would have had that understanding. The rest of the steps were not quite as challenging, but there's been parts where I just had to trust what my sponsor said to do and do it, because my best thinking had not worked. There's four stages of learning that I think that we experience when we get here. There's unconscious incompetence, which is when you don't know what you don't know, which is what I had when I was before I got here. I didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't know there was hope. I didn't know there was a solution. I didn't know I was alcoholic. I didn't know what alcoholism was. And then there's conscious incompetence, when you know what you don't know. And that's what I had when I first got here. Suddenly I tapped into something, and I didn't know what it was, but I suddenly knew there was something I needed to learn more about. There was something out there I wanted to know more about. Conscious incompetence. And then there's conscious competence, when you know what you know. And after I'd worked the steps, I began to know some things about myself. Not all of them were very pleasant. I had to swallow some large chunks of truth about myself, as it says, you know, when I did my fifth step. And I saw how selfish and self-centered and afraid I was, and how those motives drove a lot of my behaviors. And then there's unconscious competence, which is what happens when you're talking to a sponsee and you hear yourself say something you didn't even know was in you. And it's not only hopefully what they needed to hear, but what you needed to hear, where you don't know what you know. And that has been the evolution for me in this program. I've received the power of choice in drink by coming here and working these steps and submitting to direction, good orderly direction, and keeping spiritually fit. Just as I acted my way into my sick thinking, and that just as my behavior got bad faster than I could lower my standards, I had to act my way out. I had to trust and obey and do things I didn't understand before I understood them, to begin to have an understanding of them and to begin to have the thoughts and feelings that would come after. I didn't have to understand them to do them. I had to do them first, and then the understanding came. And then the peace came. And the nine-step promises are the nine-step promises. They come after they talk about the ninth step. That's when you make the amends. That is when you begin to see, you know, if you begin to have a new freedom and a new happiness. You begin to not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. You comprehend the word serenity, and we know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Our whole attitude and outlook on life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. Everything baffled me. I was terrified of everything and of everyone. I didn't know how to handle any social situations. Any situations, period. Family situations. Work situations. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. They will materialize if we work for them. And the great pleasure I have today is being able to use those very things that I thought I would never not cringe about when I looked back at. You know, those standards that I had blown through of my own, those experiences that I thought I'd never want to share with another human being. I share them now on a regular basis in my work with others, and it helps them. And they get to relate, and, you know, God willing, they get to stick and stay and begin to put their lives back together. There's three purpose statements in the big book. On page 68, it tells us we are in the world to play the role he assigns. On page 77, it tells us our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And on page 102, it tells us our job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So what I do now that keeps me on track is I go to meetings to stay reminded, to stay encouraged, and to stay connected to you, because not only is that where you're my family, not only is this where I find my joy and my peace and, you know, where I relate, I am most at home when I'm in a room full of recovering alcoholics and addicts. But it's also where I get to give back. I get to use that stuff I never thought would be useful, and I get to turn that into something that can help somebody else. I do a book study at my house every other Thursday, which keeps me in the literature. And I practice my faith on Sundays and Monday nights. That just keeps my higher power. That's the who for me. And I work my program with my sponsor, which is the how for me. I keep myself in the steps. So it's an honor to be up here tonight. And I thank you all for all you've given me over the years. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula.
Living high. a big piece of the pie. So many they got it wrong. As for me, when I wanted too much, ain't never enough. Myself, hide it from everyone else, save it for a rainy day. If you wanna have it all the time, gotta give it away. All I had below, kept it on. If you want love all the time, give it to someone else. I want everyone around to see just how much your love means to me. Baby, wear it on my sleeve. It'll never leave if I give it and dress.